Tonight on Arena, we celebrate the 25th anniversary of Seamus Heaney's Nobel Prize win and new albums from Taylor Swift, The Avalanches, and Guided by Voices up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Authors, actors and ambassadors come together for a one-off programme of performances to mark the 25th anniversary of the award of the Nobel Prize in Literature to Seamus Heaney. Seamus Heaney Home Place, the literary centre which celebrates the poet's life and work, is staging a series of virtual events available from today. With me in studio is Mick Heaney, Seamus Heaney's son, and his biographer Roy Foster is on the line, and we're marking the 25th anniversary of his Nobel Prize for Literature. In fact, Mick, you were saying the 25th anniversary plus one day.
Plus one day, yeah. It was on a Sunday, the Nobel banquet. But there was a suite of events, because I think the Nobel lecture, which is always brought up, was delivered about 2 or 3 days beforehand. So, you know, I think at this stage we were heading back on the plane.
Yeah, I haven't had a great time. Well, I want to actually play a clip for you, because, of course, the great story at the time was, would your father be down in Sandymount when the phone call came? No, of course he wouldn't be. He wasn't in the country at all. So at home in Sandymount, where your older brother, Christopher, your younger sister...
And younger brother.
Chris is younger.
Yeah, yeah, need to get the pecking order.
So the older brother was off about town, and the two younger siblings were left to deal with things. Let's have a listen to this.
We haven't heard from him, and we don't have any number for him. No one else does, so as far as we know, no, he doesn't know yet.
Is there a family celebration planned, Chris?
I would imagine so. I'll imagine there'll be a small one tonight with his offspring, and then I'm sure there'll be a big one when he comes home. Yeah, oh God, I hope so.
Catherine, how do you think he will react when he does hear the news eventually?
I think he'll be elated and definitely very shocked. I mean, I don't really, he wasn't expecting this, and none of us were, but I think he'll be very pleased and really shocked.
And that's Catherine and Christopher Heaney, the youngest of the three siblings, who were left at home to carry the can while mum and dad were off in Greece. And big brother Mike was, who knows what he was doing in the middle of town. I'm sure you were working very hard, Michael.
I was working very hard, and indeed I was. They visited me in my flat at the time to ask for my reaction, but I didn't have the quotes ready.
Yeah.
So they went to the source.
What happened? I mean, did they phone the house and either Chris or Catherine picked up the phone?
A fax came through.
All right.
And actually,
in the days of faxes.
But the strange thing was, certainly how I remember I found out, was that I got a call from the RTE newsroom beforehand saying, there's a rumour that he'll be getting the Nobel. And I went, look, this happens every year.
Yeah,
it never happens. And then I saw on the 1 o'clock news that he had won it. But in the meantime, the facts had come through in Strand Road. Wow. So we knew, but as they say, they didn't.
They didn't. And you knew where they were, but was tracking them down particularly difficult, your mum and dad?
Well, they didn't have it's pre-mobile phone. It's that
so
thing.
Didn't just send a text saying,
and they were in Greece, and it was his first time in Greece, which was huge for him, with his friends, Dimitri and Cynthia Hadzi. So they were in blissful ignorance for, 24, 36 hours. And then they phoned and, My brother told Dad, who I think, was stunned, and said, talk to your mother. And of course, I think she expected the worst.
Well, let's listen. I think it's Tommy Gorman. Yeah, Tommy Gorman here talks about that moment of how the news was actually broken. So Tommy was sent off to Greece. There's a nice assignment. Greece and find Seamus Heaney. The temptation to not find him for a day or two must have been great, but Tommy did his job.
The search for the Nobel Prize winner took us over the Aegean Sea, beyond the ancient city of Sparta in the Peloponnese. He had been holidaying there with his wife, Mary, along with their friends, Dimitri and Cynthia Kadzi, in blissful ignorance that he had been awarded the most famous honour in the world.
I rang home, Christopher, son at home, I know he's usually in on a Friday afternoon, so I rang home. And he said, did you hear? I said, no. He said, you've won the Nobel Prize. I said, come on. And he said, no. And this was Friday afternoon, and the news had come in on Thursday, apparently. And I have a great sympathy, I must say, for Christopher and Catherine and Michael, who are at home holding the fort in the middle of all this, and we were out of contact entirely.
Yes, the fact checkers will be here to say Christopher and Catherine, who were at home holding the fort, and Michael, who was in his flat,
yes,
holding
yes,
a different fort.
Yes.
However, look, I'm sure you've had enough stick given to you by the family for that over the years, so I better let it go. Roy Foster, obviously that kind of family story has been heard many times, but it always merits retelling. Do you remember when you heard something that was more than just a rumour, Roy? And I'm guessing you probably thought, well, sure, he was bound to win it and he needed to win it and it's right that he wins it.
Well, I remember it very distinctly because I was in my rooms in Oxford with Seamus's close friend and mine, the poet Tom Paulin, who also taught then in Oxford. And a phone call came through, I think from the newspaper or something, to my rooms telling me this and wanting a quote about it, because Seamus was a big Oxford figure. He'd given the professor of poetry lectures just a few years before. So Tom and I were completely thrown by it. We were, I think we opened a bottle of wine at a very unseasonable hour of the day. We felt that's what Seamus would have wanted. But it was a great thing. It was indeed a great thing. And I remember it very distinctly. It's extraordinary to think it was 25 years ago. But just remembering we didn't have mobile phones does make it seem like in another era.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that you'd have to spend 24 to 48 hours tracking somebody down now just seems so ridiculous, you know, because everybody's so connected, contactable. Unless, of course, you might turn the mobile phone off if you were off on a Greek holiday and you didn't want to be disturbed. That'd be perfectly acceptable too. But in terms of his actually being awarded that prize, right, it wasn't a surprise in the bigger, yes, the getting the news and all of those things. Yeah, that was a surprise. But when you would sit back and analyse it, it wasn't that big a surprise that he would win it.
No, it wasn't. I think it was, there was a kind of expectation. I mean, other names were bruited about, but, and the kind of Irish tradition of great Nobel winners, you know, not only Beckett in, what was it, 1969, but Shaw in 1925-6, Yeats in 1923, there seemed a kind of propriety about it, almost.
Yeah.
And certainly Yeats's Nobel was a very key moment because it was just after Irish independence, and Yeats made it an occasion to emphasise that this was, in a sense, an award to Ireland on a taking its place on a world stage. And Seamus did a little of the same in his extraordinarily moving and powerful acceptance speech, which was later published as Crediting Poetry. He talked very directly and powerfully about violence in Northern Ireland and the background out of which his life and his poetry had been born.
Yeah, he quoted from North, from it wasn't it the poem Exposure that he read from during the speech?
He quoted Exposure. He also, interestingly, quoted Yeats's Meditations in Time of Civil War, The Star's Nest by My Window, which is a kind of plea, almost a prayer, an invocation for peace at a time of internecine strife. Mm. And that, I think, was very much the key of what he was trying to say in that lecture.
And referenced directly the King's Mill massacre, you know, the situation where the Protestants...
He did, He did, yes, indeed. It's one of his great pieces of prose, I think, as well as must have been... Well, Mick would have heard it.
Yeah.
An extraordinary thing to hear as a speech.
I would have thought that, Mick. I mean, sitting listening to a speech like that, yes, you must have been listening to it as, you know, whatever, with some kind of objectivity, but it's your dad up there giving this speech. It must have been a phenomenal moment in those terms.
Yeah, I mean, you have that weird sense of occasion. The other thing about listening to lectures, of course, is that you also find yourself staring off into the corner going, I really need to concentrate on this. And I reread it there just before this, you know, and again, that's when it starts, you know, I really wish I'd paid a bit more attention.
Yeah.
But it was in a slightly, not the most prepossessing setting. I mean, it was a lecture hall or somewhere.
Yeah.
It wasn't super grand. It wasn't like the banquet itself. But it's a great, it is a terrific speech, and starts off with a paying to radio because it, you know, he's how he located Stockholm was on the wireless dial.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's from this medium, it's opposite.
I have another section from him here. He mentions the three of you, and a moment, a family moment in the midst of all of the, you know, because it must have been so high flown, the winning of the Nobel Prize, the speech, the banquet, all of those things. And this was your father's reaction just to, I think you had said there'd be no crying. Yeah, and let's just hear the exact words that you used. Very Ulster, I have to say.
It was an emotional time indeed, and has been, but my family are kind of fairly robust. My son Michael said, no blubbering now, he said. But I did have, as they say, eye contact with them as I bowed towards the audience, and that was one of the happiest eye contacts I've had with my family ever.
That's a lovely. I saw that actually, Mick. I was watching it online today, and I can see you sitting there beside your mother, and big smile on your face. It obviously was hugely proud. Do you remember the eye contact from your side?
I do remember that, and you know what I was saying, for instance, about the lecture, which is it's slightly you're doing your duty, but the festivities themselves is a giant banquet, which is televised strangely on Swedish television for the night, and they parse the menu apparently like criminologists. but there really was a sense of pride and nervousness, you know, because he was going up there and he'd had the flu, he had flu symptoms. Mm. So he was slightly nervous himself, and he could often handle these things quite well, and he did. But I think he was, you know, I think the occasion certainly had him more jangled than he would have admitted, you know.
To be fair. You win the Nobel Prize, you could be forgiven for being a little bit tongue-tied. Well, he certainly wasn't tongue-tied, no. if jangled, not tongue-tied. Do you think, you know, to be in there, as Roy Foster has pointed out, to be in there with particularly with Yeats, that comparison constantly made between your father and Yeats, but in there with Shaw as well, in there with Beckett, Was it a heavy weight on his shoulders? Do you think he was very aware of the win after he had it?
I think he was hugely aware of it. And again, I was just reading Stepping Stones, and it was more or less, as you said, joy and a gradual burdening. And I think there was that worry that, you know, that somehow it would weigh down on your work, that you might somehow, the pressure of expectations would somehow not kill the work, but that you might try and respond to it too much. And he was lucky in that the spirit level was, he had that written and it came out the following year. But, you know, when Electric Light came out, there was definitely, he was worried about those things. And I don't think he needed to be in the end.
Yeah.
Because certainly, you know, the next three more collections, and they were, you know, I think the last one in particular, Human Chain, is phenomenal. But yeah, he was definitely aware of it. There were, you'd mentioned Yeats. I mean, I think his hero, real hero, was Czesław Miłosz, who'd won it. And I think that probably made him feel even more nervous. And he'd friends like Derek Walcott and Joseph Brodsky had won it. I have a feeling that sin that might have helped him, you know, that he knew people to do it. But yeah, no, there's no question that he was worried about it, you know.
I want to play another poem of your father's here, and I don't know where this fits in with the specifics of whether he actually did this in. I think he might have done this was there a theatre event, very small theatre event where about 180 people were present, and he did a poetry, and I think that's where he read this particular poem.
Is there a particular poem that comes to mind at this time? Having said, just as you said, you think of those close to you at a time like this.
Well, one of the poems that have been most popular and most greeted, and one of the poems I like best, there's a set of poems actually I wrote after the death of my mother, which really is about the first emotional place, and it's just a memory of peeling potatoes, and so I know it by heart. I have no books with me here, so it has the virtue of being short and being true to my memories. Yeah. When all the others were away at mass, I was all hers as we peeled potatoes. They broke the silence, let fall one by one, like solder weeping off the soldering iron.
cold comfort set between us, things to share, gleaming in a bucket of clean water. And again let fall. Little pleasant splashes from each other's work would bring us to our senses. So while the parish priest at her bedside went hammer and tongs at the prayers for the dying, and some were responding, and some crying, I remembered her head bent towards my head, her breath in mine, our fluent dipping knives, never closer the whole rest of our lives.
It's such a wonderful poem. I've always loved that poem, Mick. And in fact, it was an on-street interview. It was where that happened. It wasn't in the theatre at all. It was with about Tommy Gorman again. It was an RTE interview. And to just say that in the street, it's still full of all that emotion.
Yeah, I mean, that's where, you know, as someone who's perhaps not the most poetic person in the world, you realise that to have poems sort of in the store that you can come out. And they speak to all sorts of emotion. That poem is terrific, because I remember her, you know.
Yeah,
very
of course.
Well, you know?
Yeah. We do have Roy Foster back, and I just want to, Roy, if you would tell us a little bit about the events in the home place that are taking place. They're available online from this evening. So yours is already done. What specifically were you addressing in your talk?
The significance of the prize, the way it places Seamus Heaney in Irish literary history. Comparisons with how Beckett received it and how Yeats received it, and the use that Yeats made of his reception of it, and the great contrast with Beckett, who did a runner to Portugal, I think, and refused to go near Stockholm and wouldn't even let the Irish ambassador receive it on his behalf. He insisted his publisher went. And Seamus's rather more gracious reaction to it and what he made of it in crediting poetry, which we discussed at some length.
Yeah, and we were speaking to, I asked Michael just when we lost you there briefly, I asked him about this idea of how the prize weighed on Seamus, and Michael was saying that there was some worry, but that he felt that it wasn't there at all. Do you see any difference, positive or negative, in the work post the Nobel win?
Well, I think I'm probably echoing what Mick said here, that it was fortunate that Spirit Level was in the work, so to speak, because it's one of his most powerful collections, and it has poems in it like My Sinai Lookout, which are some of the most extraordinary things he'd ever done. And it ends with Postscript, which again is a very much loved poem. I think, and I say this in my book, that there is a slight waver in Electric Light. It's not as achieved a collection as some of them. And that's the one that is the poems, in fact, that he was writing around the time just after he won the Nobel. But then he's right back on form with District and Circle, and Human Chain is very last collection, my favourite.
I'm going to ask you've chosen a poem for us to finish with, Roy, Into Arcadia.
Yes, which again, because it reflects being in Greece at the very time when he heard this extraordinary news, which did change his life and hit him, as he says, I think in the Stepping Stones interviews, as a mostly benign avalanche, an avalanche,
I mean, I should just add that Roy writes about this phenomenally in his recent book. He captures it. I know you spoke about it, but it's the only thing I learned more about it as well.
It's good to learn about your dad from somebody else. Let's finish up then by listening to Sonnets from Hellas, Into Arcadia, read by Seamus Heaney.
Sonnets from Hellas. 1. Into Arcadia. It was opulence and a man on the mountain road. Walnuts bought on a high pass from a farmer who'd worked in Melbourne once and now trained water through a system of pipes and runnels of split reed known in Hellas probably since Hesiod. That was the least of it. When we crossed the border from Argos into Arcadia and farther into Arcadia, a lorry load of apples had burst open on the road, so that for yards our tyres runched and scrunched them, but we drove on, juiced up and fleshed and spattered, revelling in it. And then it was the goat herd, with his goats in the forecourt of the filling station, subsisting beyond eclogue and translation.
Seamus Heaney there with Sonnets from Hellas, one into Arcadia, the choice of Roy Foster for us on this special evening, remembering the Nobel laureate win of Seamus Heaney 25 years ago. Thanks to Mick Heaney for coming into us this evening, Mick, and to Roy Foster, who was on the phone with us. And a Nobel celebration, more spacewalk than stepping stone, referring to that Nobel speech again. A virtual event with tickets available online, viewing from Seamus Heaney's home place website. And you can get that on Seamus Heaney Home. com. Edvard Munch, the Norwegian expressionist painter, has been Tracy Emin's favourite artist since she was 18. In a new documentary going out tonight on BBC Two, she talks about his art and her own as she realises a lifetime's ambition, a joint exhibition of their work. The joint exhibition is called The Loneliness of the Soul, and it's now on show at the Royal Academy in London. The documentary is called Emin Munch, Between the Clock and the Bed. Paula Shields has been watching it for us, and she is with me in studio now. I'm kind of not surprised in some ways that Emin likes Munch and that he was an important artist in terms of her development, Paula. But exhibiting the two of them, exhibiting together, or her works opposite his works, you know, we're talking about My Bed and Everyone I Ever Slept With, you know, with the, those type of works where you have, how many names is it that she's embroidered into? How many?
It's 102, Sean.
102 actual names stitched into a large tent. Do they sit easily together for you? Are they an obvious choice?
No, they're not obvious, not at all. You think about Tracy Emin. She came of professional age as one of the young British artists, you know, along with Damien Hirst, the Cool Britannia mob in the 1990s. The art was brash, it was provocative. That applique tent, you know, you can't imagine Munch, those beautiful, harrowing paintings. You just can't imagine him putting up every ex-girlfriend he ever had and naming them like that. And yet, the documentary and the exhibition make the case that they both deal in dark subject matter. You know, they're both interested in intense emotion. It's love, it's loss, it's illness, yeah. It's death. There are lots of points of contact.
And I suppose when I think about the Scream, which is the obvious one to think of when you think of Munch, kind of Emin's art is a kind of a scream of its own kind. It's different from his painting, but it is a loud protest. Protest isn't the right, but it's a loud shout from the gut.
Well, you know, we expect most artists to use their own lives in their work, but both Munch and Emin do that to excess almost.
Yeah, and in the documentary, she talks a little bit about how they use their own lives and indeed the connections between the two of them. Let's have a listen to a clip.
Munch has a lot of bed paintings. Like the bed represents, it's like the death of myself, the shadow of myself, the former self, and it's like a living death as well. And I think for Munch, the bed has always been a symbol of, first of all, a place of fear, because it's where people died that he loved. Another place of fear where he had very unsuccessful sex as well, or a place where he was going to die. And I think for Munch, the bed represented something, otherwise it wasn't going to be there. I can honestly say my bed came around through the strangest of circumstances, and it was organic. But when I made it, it wasn't about that at all. It was purely about me. It was something to do with me. And it kind of made itself as well. What I did was remove things from it. The figure's gone, everything's been removed, but it's the same thing, it's still death.
Extraordinary the way Tracy Emin there speaks about death in that BBC documentary that Paula Shields is speaking to us about tonight. She's had a particularly bad, a tough year, has she, Emin, hasn't she, Paula?
She has. Only announced in October that in June this year she was diagnosed with advanced bladder cancer spread to other internal organs. She had major surgery in July. She's in remission at the moment. So in the documentary, she looks pale, she looks a little tired. It's still her, though. And what's interesting about the exhibition is there is some new work in it, and there's a series of portraits called Insomnia, where she's taken photographs. They're blown up to 2 metres high, each of these works. And anyone who's ever had insomnia, cancer aside, will it recognise the look on her face, the look in her eyes, that kind of misery? But she herself is excited about the series and she says they're seminal, the work is seminal. So you kind of feel she's still here. But yes, she's had a very serious year.
The intellectual energy, she may be tired and obviously has been through a very difficult illness, and hopefully the remission lasts for quite a long time. But the intellectual energy, just from the little bits of the documentary I saw, there's nothing missing there.
Absolutely not. And she's so interesting on his work all the way through and on her own. Just the insights she brings to bear and the things she's pointing out. You really, if we didn't know about the cancer, you wouldn't look at her and think this is someone who's wasted away or anything like that.
And finally then, there's going to be a permanent connection between Munch and Emin next spring in Oslo. What's happening there?
Yes, there's a new Edvard Munch Museum opening in Oslo, and this exhibition is going from the Royal Academy to that new building. But also she has made a 9 metre high bronze sculpture called The Mother, and it's going to be installed outside that museum on the waterfront.
Wow.
And it's particularly poignant when you realise that Emin modelled it on her own mother, who died in 2016, but Munch famously lost his own mother at the age of 5, first in the series of tragedies. But the work is beautiful. It's a kind of crouching, kneeling figure. She's looking down. She's looking at something in her hands you can't quite see, but it's lovely to think that there will be a permanent piece of Emin in Oslo, and as there should be.
That mother connection is a lovely detail as well. You're saying watch this documentary as well.
Oh, it's 40 minutes of pure gold.
Yeah, 40. It's a bit late, but it is 40 minutes. It's at 11:20 this evening. We suppose you can always tape it. If, like me, you can't keep the eyes open that late at night. Emin Munch, Between the Clock and the Bed. BBC Two this evening, 11:20. And the exhibition then, Tracy Emin, Edvard Munch, The Loneliness of the Soul, at the Royal Academy in London until the 28th of February. Pandemic restrictions permitting. And so to the final lap on Friday evening album reviews. First up this evening will be Taylor Swift. Took the world and her fans by surprise yesterday afternoon, announcing the release of her 9th album, available from midnight Eastern Time. That's 5 a.m. this morning here in Ireland. And the new album's called Evermore. The Avalanches give us her 2nd album for review this evening, an electronic music group formed in Melbourne 1997. First album, groundbreaking, Since I Left You in 2000. 16 years before they gave us their follow-up, Wildflower, relatively brief 4 years to get this one, which is called We Will Always Love You. And finally, veteran American indie rockers Guided by Voices released their 3rd album of this year. This one is called Styles We Paid For. Simon Marr, Kate Brennan-Harding have been listening. Let's start with Taylor Swift, and the lead single off Evermore is called Willow. Baby, let's go. Willow, the opening track and the lead single off Taylor Swift's new album Evermore. Simon Marr and Kate Brennan-Harding were the listeners for this week. Which of you was up at 5 o'clock this morning to listen to this? I presume it was you, Simon Marr.
No, it wasn't. I waited till breakfast time, and I put it on when I got into the car. Again, not knowing what to expect.
And were you surprised? Were you happy? What did you feel when you started listening?
Do you know, I was surprised for a start that it was quite similar to the previous album, which was Folklore, but not necessarily in a bad way, because I enjoyed Folklore far more than I thought it would. And it's one of those combinations was that I love a sort of a country twang in a song, and I love the national. And if you kind of get those two things together, you go, well, this isn't really going to work out too bad for me anyway. Yeah. So it was already, it got itself a decent head start.
Yeah, well, I'll come to you then, Kate. You can tell me, first of all, what time you listened to the album, and since it was available from 5 o'clock. And you might explain the reference that Simon made there to the National and the Desner Brothers, who are involved in this album as they were in the earlier one this year.
Yeah, they're involved, and you can hear their influence throughout. But I mean, Taylor is. I didn't start out as a Swiftie. I was never a huge fan. I've always liked her music, but I have to say, the last few years, I've really grown to love her. And I for the record, I was awake at 6:30 this morning, but that wasn't just to listen to the album, but it was handy.
Yeah, okay.
That it was out.
So you're not quite a full blown Swiftie yet, but you're an hour and a half later Swiftie.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, I have to say, I loved Folklore when it was released. And I like that we have these big artists who are taking a look, an introspective kind of look, and changing up what they do while still applying. Like she, for my mind, I think she's a genius songwriter. She's one of the biggest songwriters of our generation. And I think what she's doing here with Evermore, it's a little bit lighter. It is not as sort of heavy as Folklore, and I think it offers hope for going into the new year as well. I felt like it was like being wrapped up in a big blanket. It was kind of gorgeous and perfect for this time of year as well.
Yeah, and I think something that happened with Folklore, and I'm not so sure how fair it was, everybody said, oh yeah, it's great, and that's because of the involvement of the Dessner brothers. A lot of what's happening on both albums, and certainly on this one to my ear, it's Taylor Swift, it's her songwriting, and it's a kind of a little bit of her country roots coming back into play, Simon.
Oh, it absolutely is. And it's one of the great things about an album like this is that you can tell even the first album, Folklore, was probably a little bit more autobiographical. Mm. But on Evermore, it's real. It's almost like she's created a cast of characters and that she's written songs about this cast of characters. And she's put together such really, really impressive stories about all of them. There was never any question about her performance or her voice or any of that stuff. But the fact that she's able to write such good stories is a real tribute to her and something I was very, very impressed with on both albums.
Yeah, and she calls this cottagecore. What does that mean, Kate?
Well, my take on it is the same as, I can't pronounce the word, is it haig? Or, you know, the the feeling of, the sensation of coziness. But what she's actually talking about is the fact that she says, you know, she was standing and looking through the woods, and then for this album, she couldn't stop writing, and they decided to venture further into the woods. But for me, it's definitely kind of, you're sitting down and you are more enveloped in a softer sound. And that's where I think cottagecore comes from.
Right, let's have a listen to another track on the album. Evermore features Bon Iver. Cannot think of all the cost and the things that will be lost. Or can we just get a pause to be certain we'll be tall again? Just wanted to get a little bit of Bon Iver in there. It's a 5-minute song, but it's no sacrifice to wait for him to come in. And it is that the two voices really do fit well together. Would you agree, Simon?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the thing, is that they managed to get that. And, you know, bringing in like Jack Antonoff, who was involved at, you know, Taylor Swift going way back, we call the pop producer, manages to keep everything together, manages to keep it from maybe going a little bit too country, or that little bit too modern internationally, or that little bit too pop. And they've also worked out is that there are certain voices that Swift works really, really well with. There's the track she's on with Haim. There's the stuff with Justin Vernon. You know, there's Matt Berninger. The people who appear on it are people, they all complement one another.
Hygge, by the way, I'm told, Kate, was the, was the word you were saying to. Hygge, which means a kind of a kind of a cosy, huggy type of feel in Denmark.
Yeah.
It's a Danish word. Anyway, there you go. What about Taylor Swift for you? Does the album work overall? When pandemic restrictions lift, will all of the restrictions lift on her life as well, and will we be back to full-scale pop and stars? That's from you, Kate.
So firstly, like, one of the things I think is really important to note is that Taylor Swift is an artist that has traversed lots of different genres already, and I kind of feel that this is just another progression, and she'll go back to pop, and she'll probably do disco. And I think that that is just something wonderful to see, someone not staying in a particular lane. If she'd stayed in her lane, she'd still be doing country. Do you know what I mean? And she was phenomenal at that as well. So for me, the whole album works, and it is really lovely. It's lovely for this time of year as well. I am giving it 4 out of 5.
4 hygges out of 5. And what are you saying, Simon?
I think 4 hygges out of 5 is very, very fair. And I think Kate is absolutely spot on, is that she has managed to, even if this is just another chapter in the career of Taylor Swift or in the style book of Taylor Swift, you know, it's great and it's something that's well worth having.
All right, so good, solid, double 4 stars there for Evermore from Taylor Swift. Let's move on to album number 2, the Avalanches, Australian electronic duo. They seem to be competing for the least prolific band in the world, unlike the third one we're going to talk about. Debut album in 2000, follow-up 16 years later, and now they rushed the next one out 4 years on from that in 2020, just at the end of 2020. Album number 3, a concept album called We Will Always Love You. What is the concept, Kate Brennan Harding?
Well, the concept, in my mind, is absolutely beautiful. So the thing is, anyone who doesn't know the Avalanches, what they do and what they are like probably some of the best in the world at doing is taking samples from records and putting them on loops and continuously creating new sounds with these samples. So what they've done is they've taken, they thought about all the voices that have gone before. So all the people that they would be listening to, but their voices still exist on record and they're out in the ether from radio broadcasts, etc., but they're gone. So they were looking at the everlasting and the cosmos and the fact that, you know, sound waves are beamed out into space. Even the cover of the album is a woman called Andrian, and she recorded her brainwaves. Basically to send them out into deep space on the Voyager space probe. So it's a love affair between Andrian and a scientist called Carl Sagan. And so they took their love story and decided to start creating something. What they want to do is to create positive energy out into the world through sound waves. And I love that. I love it, and I love this album, just in case you don't get that already.
Yeah, I kind of picked that up a little bit off you. All right, let's listen to the title track, We Will Always Love You. We Will Always Love You, title track from the new album from the Avalanches. And it kind of, it's almost, Simon, it works, almost every second track is more like a little interlude or one of those voices that Kate was telling us about. Now, maybe it was the digital particular way I was listening to it. You really need to hear this, I think, as a continuous listen, if you know what I mean, rather than having to stop and then get the next track up. You know what I mean? Sometimes on digital platforms, you don't get that kind of smooth listen right through.
Yeah, it would be one of those things that there's probably three or four, we call them singles, that jump off the album. But for the rest of it, yeah, it's this long. And it's 25 tracks, it's 71 minutes, so it's quite long.
Yeah.
But it's literally as if Spiritualized and Public Service Broadcasting got together and had a really cute baby and they produced this album. You know, and there's so much that comes of it. And the more that you listen to it, and the more time that you give it, the better and better that it sounds. But even from a musical point of view, when you listen to it, you go, 4 years, how did they do it? I can understand why the previous album took 16 years, because there's so much that's in this. It's so dense that 4 years worth of samples, and then for the vocals that they put on them, it's almost like it's done in jig time.
Yeah, and an extraordinary list of collaborators. Even getting them together in the space of 4 years is quite an achievement, Kate.
Yeah, it is. And like, the thing is that Chatter, who writes he gets most of the samples, you know, he talks about he had a list of people that he wanted to work with. They had a list of people and they communicated over email, and he had this concept and he needed to know that they were on board with the concept. So you've got like Johnny Marr, you've got Blood Orange, you've got Kurt Vile. Their list just goes on and on of really brilliant collaborators and really brilliant use. Like Leon Bridges, his voice pops up across some of the songs. Like he's mainly featured on one song and then he sort of pops and appears in different parts of the album. But it's really cohesive because they all came together with one idea and he worked with people who had the one idea that understood he was coming from with the concept.
Well, let's listen to a track called We Go On, and the collaborators here have the very good manners to introduce themselves very at the beginning of the very track. Why am I fighting to stay on this payroll? I've heard, but the won't be so We Go On, the title of that track from the Avalanches album, We Will Always Love You. And Simon, it's really across all of those tracks, we get a huge variety of styles as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's no two tracks that are particularly alike on this. Like, you know that they have that vibe where they kind of love the slightly dancier sort of stuff, but the quite mellow dancey stuff. But there's bits in it, and because they're having to build an awful lot of the music around the samples that they have and the bits that they want to use, and particularly because this is all so centered around space and the afterlife and everything, is that they've got these things, and then it's as if they build the track from there up, and it means that you're going to end up with a song that perhaps even in their eyes was going to start off one way, but when they put it together you get the feeling that it has just built and it's grown completely of its own accord.
Right. I'm getting the impression that you, Simon Marr, are probably in a similar boat to Kate Brennan-Harding, in that she was not doubting or very quick to express her absolute love of this album. So I'll leave whether that is the case with you and get your stars in a minute. But I'm going to ask Kate Brennan for her stars, because I reckon it's going to be pretty positive from you, Kate.
It is, yeah. I sent you my notes and I had given them 4.5 out of 5, but actually on second and third listen again today, I'm giving them 5 out of 5. I love
five
it.
5 out of 5. And what are you saying, Simon?
Oh my goodness, the pressure is on now. This is a truly, truly great album, and I think it's very worthy of it. I'm giving it my 4.5 out of 5, definitely. But it's very, very good.
Another couple of listens, you'll be in Kate's boat with the 5 out of 5. But 4.5 for the moment from
probably,
the Avalanches.
Probably so, yeah.
You're right. Let us move on then to our final album for this evening, Guided by Voices. Third album this year? Yes, the third album this year. And Styles We Have Paid For is the name of the album. Here is a track called Crash at Lake Placebo. A little bit of Crash at Lake Placebo there, which comes in the total song at 2 minutes and 45 seconds. I'd say, Kate Brennan, there's hardly a song on this album definitely longer than 3 minutes. Is there even one longer than 3 minutes? I see one there, 3.5 minutes, but they're very short.
Yeah, they're very short. There is one called Slaughterhouse at 4.5 minutes, and I did feel a little bit like I was at the slaughterhouse when listening to it. But that's also a little bit probably advancedly unfair, because I actually got some joy out of listening to it over a number of times, you know, over a number of listens. The band are amazing in terms of their legacy. I wasn't aware, I have to say this, I was not aware of them, which I can feel lots of indie heads going in shock and horror at me, but I didn't know who they were. And they wouldn't be a genre or a type of music that I would actively go and search. They released 3 albums this year. Their lead singer is a guy called Robert Pollard. They've been going since the early 80s. They've had huge amounts of change in the band, Robert being the central figure.
Yeah.
They seem to be heavily inspired by 60s sounds, as well as they were part of the grunge and indie movement. So like the album itself is only 38 minutes long. It's 15 songs. Personally, I think that there's a lot of clutter in there as well, you know.
Well, now, funny enough, when I said they're all very short, I was probably trying to lead you down or up some particular garden path that I wanted to go up. So let me try to see if Simon will agree with me. What I thought, Simon, was what I thought. I simply thought you have 15 songs here. Some of them are a couple of minutes long. Would you ever give us 12 songs and let them be fully realised ideas? And it's your third album this year. Less is sometimes more.
In the normal run of things, Sean, I would agree. But this is their 32nd album. And they've been a band that... Like Robert Pollard sits down and he burps out hooks. That seems to be what he does. And then they say, right, we need at least 1.5 minutes of a song to go around this. And it seems that they live in a state of constant chaos. And they made a decision at some point in their career that, look, we're not even going to try. You know, if we come up with something we think is a hook, we'll wrap a bit of a song around it, we'll release it, and we'll go with it. Yeah. And they just keep on releasing and releasing and releasing. And they paused for about 3 or 4 years. And I think poor Robert Pollard, it was nearly the end of him. He had to get back to it. He released a bunch of solo albums, but then he had to come back to it. And now it's as if all of this stuff is bursting out of him.
I'll grant you, hooks he can do. There's no doubt about that. But a hook needs to develop into a song for me. Stars from you, Simon, first of all.
Do you know, I was surprised, despite the chaos, and maybe because it's the inside of my head is full of chaos, is that I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. So I'm actually going to give this 3.5.
3.5 from you, Kate?
Oh, 2 out of 5.
2 out of 5. I'm with you on that one, Kate. Guided by Voices, Styles We Paid For, The Avalanches, We Will Always Love You, and Taylor Swift's Evermore were the 3 albums that Kate Brennan Harding, Simon Marr speaking to us about this evening. That's our lot for this week. Liam Murphy, Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy, the broadcast coordinator. Damien Chanel in sound. Tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. Have a great weekend.